From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Reagan Edelman. 2024 is an election year, and amid policy discussions and presidential debates, U.S. citizens are making decisions on where to cast their ballots. But there's something aside from policy and party that happens to play a role, even if we might not notice its impact. It's hair. In fact, the facial hair of former President Donald Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, has recently been in the headlines, and hair has played a role in United States politics since its founding. From George Washington's powdered pigtail to John Quincy Adams' bushy side whiskers, and from James Polk's mullet to JFK's refined cut, the hair of American leaders has long conveyed important political and symbolic messages, and has affected the way in which the public perceives them. And this isn't something new. Hair has influenced human perception since biblical times, being symbolic of everything from status to strength to the divine. In his new book, Combing Through the White House, Hair and Its Shocking Impact on Politics, Private Lives, and Legacies of the Presidents, Theodore Pappas explores the surprising and multidimensional ways that hair has influenced the men and women who have occupied the White House. And he evaluates the personal and public lives that have shaped White House history all through the lens of hair. Pappas is the long-term executive editor of Encyclopedia Britannica, and his writings have been published, anthologized, and discussed in assorted publications. Ted Pappas, welcome.
It's great to be with you.
This is such a niche field of study. I really did not have any idea what to expect when I first cracked open your book, but I was totally enthralled. So to start, I'm just kind of dying to know where this idea came from. Is there a certain head of hair that started it all?
Well, you know, actually there is. Back in the 1980s, I had, through a strange confluence of circumstances, to have a private dinner with Barbara Bush. I call it my date with Barbara Bush, or at least that's the way I remember it. It was an intimate affair, just me and Barbara and seven Secret Service agents and personal handlers. So it was a very intimate dinner. But she couldn't have been more charming. She had a wonderful sense of humor in a self-deprecating way. And she would joke about her hair. She often did during her stump speeches, but she used a line during dinner that I'd heard before, but it really lost none of its authenticity during the dinner because she was just so darn charming. And she said her time in the limelight is making a lot of white-haired, wrinkly old ladies tickle pink. And so from that, going back to the 80s, I always had that in the back of my mind. And then after 40 years of reading history, I really came to the realization that hair not only plays an incredible role in our social and cultural lives, you know, reflecting personality, identity, fashion, but also our social stereotypes, right? The dumb blonde, the blonde bombshell, the fiery redhead. But it also plays a constant role in our history.
This lens of hair through anthropology had been done, but not really through history. What did your research process look like? Where did you begin to compile all of this information from a historical lens?
It's really just 40 years of reading history. I love reading presidential history and biography, and I kept on squirreling away example after example after example of the ways in which hair weaves itself into whether domestic policy, foreign policy, and very often the private lives of the first families, often having to do with, tragedies.
As the title states, your book really hones in on presidential hair. And you start with this really shocking story that takes place during the infamous assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
I start out that chapter with the tantalizing teaser that hair was hiding the mark of the bullet that would kill the president. Because the first doctor on the scene at Ford's Theater actually didn't know Lincoln had been shot. Because John Wilkes Booth, if you remember, had leapt from the presidential box to the stage below while brandishing not a gun, but a bloody knife. And because there was no obvious wound on the president that the doctor could see, it was only after he ran his fingers through Lincoln's thick black hair was the gunshot finally discovered, the gunshot wound. Three doctors then inserted their unwashed fingers through Lincoln's hair and into his skull, trying to remove the bullet, highlighting the crude medical practices that were then common, you know, before the wide acceptance of the germ theory of disease. During the 9-hour death vigil that followed, while doctors really just tried to keep the president comfortable while he lay dying. Folks were, you know, there were some 60 to 90 folks who visited his bedside during that 9-hour period, and many of them came armed with scissors in order to cut snippets of Lincoln's hair to take with them as intimate keepsakes of the tragic event. They were cutting these snippets of his hair and locks off his head while the president was still alive. And this harvesting of his locks continued the next day at the White House during and after Lincoln's autopsy. In fact, as I say in my book, the scalping of Lincoln was so prolific that it's surprising, really, that at the open casket ceremonies that followed for Lincoln across the country over the next 2 weeks, that the public didn't encounter a bald 16th president.
But his hair was a big part of who Lincoln was and a big part of how people perceived him. It played a huge role in his career, particularly with his critics, to begin. Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote that it was acquainted neither with brush or comb.
Yes.
Which I thought was a little bit funny. But tell me a little bit about his hair in his career.
Lincoln was the most body-shamed person in White House history. Hair in his body played a role in his entire life. As a child, he was endlessly mocked for his, you know, lanky physique, homely looks, his tousled hair. When he ran for president in 1860, he was called the ugliest man ever to run for the White House. And then when he grew his now famous beard to give some definition to his face, to hide his gaunt features, and when he became the first bearded president in American history, he was then roundly criticized for his hairiness, called an ape, a baboon. He really just couldn't win. However, hair likely contributed to his safety as well, especially during his dangerous train trip to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration. It was during that train ride that was very dangerous because pro-slavery fanatics hated him and many threatened to kill him. But fortunately for Lincoln, few citizens waiting for him at all the train stations along the way were not on the lookout for a bearded president to be. And there's many cases in which people waiting for the president at the train station had no idea who this bushy bearded guy was who stepped off the train. They had never seen pictures of him. Of course, there was no social media or anything at the time. And many people had the impression of him on lithographs and posters during the campaign, which showed Lincoln clean shaven. So that actually contributed to his safety as well. But yes, he's by far the most body shamed person in White House history.
And this was something that I didn't know, but it was a little girl that suggested that he grow out his facial hair, no?
Yeah, her famous letter to Lincoln suggested that, you know, the women really like facial hair, and you might want to do that, a little Grace. And he was a little hesitant. He thought, you know, he's already picked on and mocked mercilessly as it is. He thought, wouldn't they just think it's just a silly affectation? But he ultimately bites the bullet and he takes the plunge and he grows the now famous beard, which is now indelibly planted, I think, in world memory. But he did get mocked. He's then roundly called an ape, a baboon, and a gorilla for his hairiness.
You sorted the hairiness of presidents, the hair trends of presidents, into about three phases. Give me a brief synopsis of those three phases.
Yeah, I actually call it clean, hairy, clean for the three phases. During the first 50 years of American history, presidential history, you know, most of the founding fathers were clean shaven. You know, they thought facial hair was okay for the frontier trapper and the poor country farmer, but it was beneath the dignity of the landowners and businessmen of the East Coast, where our first libraries took root and our first Ivy League colleges were founded. And then, as I said, with Abraham Lincoln becoming the first bearded president, who's also the first president born west of the Appalachian Mountains, we begin to get this more of a frontier look. And during the Civil War, we have the beard gruff fighting men of the Civil War era. And that lasts for another 50 years until the last bewhiskered president. And as you hinted at, if Trump wins the presidency in the fall, J.D. Vance and his beard would be ending this 111-year prejudice against presidents with facial hair, because that was the last time we had one, was with William Howard Taft and his curly mustache in 1913. And it was during that time in the early 20th century, during the Progressive Era, that the feeling arose that America, coming off the dirty and dusty 19th century, needed to clean itself up, and that a clean-shaven look where, you know, diseases like tuberculosis could not hide and fester in one's facial hair was a cleaner, healthier look for the new male and the move at the dawn of a new century on the verge of the auto age, and better reflected the seriousness and soberness we wanted in a modern president. And if you think about it, this feeling and belief has persisted to the president. If you remember when Vice President Al Gore lost the agonizing election of 2000 to George W. Bush, what did he do? He disappeared from the limelight and he grew a beard.
For Al Gore, it was the growth of facial hair that was symbolic of him retreating from his career in politics.
That was exactly right. To the political pundits, it was his retreat from politics, from presidential politics, and he was done. And they were right. He'd never said that directly, but his hair signaling these unspoken messages said it for him.
President Kennedy is a president who I'd argue is partially known for his looks. It's no secret that he was a very handsome man, and as it turns out, he was well aware of it. Tell me a little bit about JFK's hair and his ego.
Sure. The ego was enormous, and there was constant attention paid to his hair. You know, Kennedy always wanted to appear robust, fresh, and faultless. You know, not least because, as we now know, he was secretly so unhealthy. So he took a dangerous assortment of drugs to control pain. He changed into a newly pressed outfit 3, 4, 5 times a day, meaning his White House valet was on constant call. And he had his young mistresses, of whom, of course, we know there were many, give him intricate hair treatments with special ointments to maintain his refined classic Ivy League hairstyle. But what's really interesting is that Jackie even worked to maintain her husband's perfect hairstyle, even after his death. When the U.S. Mint in 1964 released the special Kennedy Half Dollar in honor of the slain president, Jackie was unhappy with the coin's depiction of her husband's profile. She thought the hair above his ear was too heavily accented, and so the coin had to be redesigned and re-released with less pronounced waves beneath the president's famed side part, which really shows the extent to which the Kennedys went to control their carefully managed image. But consequently, given its limited release, the first version of the coin, which became known as the accented hair, Kennedy Half Dollar, skyrocketed in value. And especially fine specimens of the coin are listed online, as I looked last week, for up to $46,000. So if any of the listeners have some Kennedy Half Dollars at home, you might want to check out the date. And if they're from 1964, check out the hair above his ear, because you might be sitting on something that's worth a lot more than just 50 cents.
There's another handsome president, lesser known, the 14th president, Franklin Pierce, and his life was marked with many tragedies. But something that's still spoken about today is his hair.
Yes. You know, some have argued that he's the best looking president ever. More so than even John Kennedy. And he was the 14th president, you said, one term, 1853 to 1857. And he often is ranked as one of the worst presidents in American history. But he was strikingly handsome. He was also the youngest president yet elected in American history at that time. He was only in his 40s. He was brilliant. He gave his entire inaugural address by memory. He had a wonderful voice, a wonderful memory. And he was just a very impressive guy. He came from very strong New Hampshire stock. His father was a proud veteran of the American Revolution, etc. But he had this cascading tassel hairstyle that he wore like a movie star. And it was always something everyone commented on during his day. And even after he died at his funeral, mourners passing his open coffin routinely commented on his massive curly black hair that was still combed on a deep slant down his forehead. And you can still see this depicted in a few ways. The presidential gold dollar coin series has a wonderful depiction of Franklin Pierce. But otherwise, he's largely forgotten. But I think if people read this chapter, which I enjoyed writing because it's a chapter where I tell this dual biography of the Bushes and Franklin Pierce, exactly 100 years apart, and the tragedies they suffered, And again, getting back to my my interest in Barbara Bush in particular, and why Barbara is the second most body shamed person in White House history.
Let's talk about the woman who started it all, Barbara Bush, who sparked your interest in her. Tell me a little bit about her tragedies involving hair and how she was perceived and body shamed similarly to Lincoln.
Right. Like I said, she's second only to Lincoln as the most body shamed person in White House history, mainly because of her signature white hair and grandmotherly look. You might remember that comedian Phil Hartman repeatedly played her in drag on Saturday Night Live, if you remember those old videos. But Barbara is tied to something called the Marie Antoinette syndrome, which is when someone's hair suddenly turns white due to stress, grief, or fright. Now, this supposedly happened to the French queen due to the stress of her imprisonment and pending execution by beheading. I think that would upset a lot of people, in 1793. And it supposedly happened as well to the 28-year-old Barbara Bush after the tragic death from leukemia of her 3-year-old daughter Robin in 1953. Now, Barbara always denied this sudden overnight whitening of her hair, but her family and friends did not. And doctors, too, for centuries have denied the reality of the syndrome, you know, writing it off as something that playwrights and filmmakers from Shakespeare to Spielberg could use as a trope and sign of stress and extreme fright, but not something that really existed in reality. And they've denied it until 2020, when scientists at Harvard finally discovered a compelling tie between stressors and a sudden loss of the pigment color-producing stem cells in her hair follicles, meaning stress and grief likely were the contributing factors to the French queen's sudden white hair and to the signature white hair of one of the most admired and liked, but widely mocked and lampooned first ladies in American history, Barbara Bush.
And there's a lot of this really cool sciencey side of hair. It can provide a lot of insight on American history and previous misconceptions, such as the death of Andrew Jackson.
Yes. Yeah, you know, DNA is rewriting the history books, especially the chapters on the private lives of the presidents. Of course, DNA extractable from hair as well as from other substances. But when you think about it, Reagan, without DNA, President Clinton would likely never have been impeached because we couldn't have tied him to Monica Lewinsky's notorious blue stained dress. And as you alluded to, we wouldn't know that Andrew Jackson and Zachary Taylor, by the way, did not die from lead and arsenic poisoning, as scholars had long claimed. So thanks to science, DNA, evolving technology, and often hair analysis, we now have solutions and clarifications to many of these presidential controversies and mysteries.
You call Ben Franklin's lack of hair a diplomatic godsend for the United States. Talk to me about what you mean by that.
Sure. You know, when we sent Ben Franklin to Paris in 1776 to win French support for the American Revolution, he did something radical. He refused to wear a powdered wig, which was then diplomatic protocol. And instead, he covered his big bald head with a simple fur hat. Well, this shocked the French political class, but the French public loved it. In fact, they began to see the simple fur hat as a symbol of America and American democracy. It's untamed frontier. It's exciting experiment in freedom from a corrupt and corrupting old world empire, France's enemy, England. Women in Paris even began wearing special wigs designed specifically to resemble Franklin's famed fur hat. Called the coiffure à la Franklin, it's likely, as I say in my book, the most politically consequential hairstyle in history, because it contributed directly to the goodwill and treaty with France that were critical to America's victory in the American Revolution and the survival of that new country called the United States.
There's also this very tender story in the book about Ulysses S. Grant and his wife's hair.
Grant had two methods of coping with the common separations that are routine in military families, and particularly during the Civil War. One was he was an inveterate letter writer. He wrote to Julia, his wife, hundreds of letters, and he often enclosed flower petals and locks of his own hair. And he would do this within earshot of the battlefield and bloodshed of the battlefield during the Civil War. His other coping method was potentially more destructive, and that was drinking. But it is also very tender. Julia, his wife, when they first met and when he first left for war for the first time, they kind of gave their commitment to one another before they were married. He gave her his West Point ring to wear, and she gave him a locket of her hair. And he wore it in a locket around on a chain. And when he died, many decades later, the undertakers undressing the president to get him ready for the funeral discovered something dear right to his heart. And that was the locket she had given him 40 years before, containing his hair. So it's something he wore all the time. And it was a very special way of staying in touch with someone he deeply loved.
So coincidentally, while I was reading this book, my newsfeed was suddenly bombarded by talks of former President Donald Trump's current running mate, J.D. Vance's facial hair. You mentioned that if they were to be elected, he'd be the first in nearly a century in the White House with facial hair. What is the significance of that?
You know, there's no more risk-averse creature in the world than the campaign manager of a presidential candidate. They are as loath to take risks in soliciting votes as politicians used to be in admitting they killed the family dog. So from their really simple math and calculus, it's simply not worth it. For example, and maybe Reagan, you could weigh in on this, but women in particular can react strongly to men with facial hair. Some like it, some absolutely despise it. And so from the political campaign manager's point of view, it's not worth giving the voter anything else, any other triviality, superficiality to think about that could possibly hinder or color their vision of their candidate and color their vote. There's already too many conspiracy theories going around and social media rants. So why give them anything else to wonder about? Wow, is that beard too long? Is it too gappy? Is it too gray? Does it mean he's a supporter of gun rights? Is he a hunter? Does he kill animals? Is he going to be aggressive in foreign policy? It's not worth it from their political calculus.
More fodder for controversy and for speculation.
Exactly. So from their point of view, it's better to get the candidate, at least it has been for 111 years, it's better to get the candidate to a barber or run a woman.
And this idea that hair matters and that hair is so important, even to the media, is something that some people are aware of, at least to a degree. And as far as the White House goes, this is particularly true in the case of Hillary Clinton. Her hair was so relevant that she claimed she'd use a new style to influence the media, no?
She did. She made the statement, if I want to knock a story off the front page, I just change my hairstyle. And she did, often, you know, throwing red meat to the news hounds who are hot on her trail for the hidden meaning behind what they called every phase of her hairvolution, from scrunchie and headband to bouffant and bob. But the bottom line was, whatever style she sported, though, one message seemed clear, that the hallmark of the Hillary Clinton brand would be really far from the frills of more glamorous first ladies like Jackie Kennedy and Melania Trump. The Hillary look was instead going to be summarized, like it or not, by the three P's: pantsuits, practicality, and power hair.
You open this book up with a very endearing story of our former President Barack Obama. And this story, I think, really goes to show how meaningful hair can be.
Yeah, I opened the book with this endearing 2009 photo showing little 5-year-old Jacob Philadelphia in the Oval Office patting President Obama's head just to see if his hair was just like his. It was later called Hair Like Mine, and it became one of the most inspiring and iconic images of the Obama presidency, because to little Jacob and doubtless legions of African-American kids, if the president was just like them in this basic, fundamental, biological way, then perhaps it wasn't too much of a stretch for them to think that, yeah, maybe we too can dream big dreams and imagine a future of great accomplishment. It underscores beautifully this theme running throughout my book, and that is that hair is seldom simply hair.
That's Ted Pappas. He is the long-term executive editor of Encyclopedia Britannica, and the author of numerous books, most recently Combing Through the White House, Hair and Its Shocking Impact on Politics, Private Lives, and the Legacies of the Presidents. Ted, thank you so much.
Thank you, Reagan.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our executive producer is Matthew LaPlante. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot, and I'm Reagan Edelman. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.